Presence Ministries International presents Jesus and Paul, Two Men, Two Ages, One Story, with Tim King, recorded live during the Transmillennial National Conference, June 11 to 14, 2003. We take you now to Colorado Springs, where the program is just now beginning.
Tonight, we're going to talk about Jesus and Paul, Two Men, Two Ages, One Story. This is a broad topic. It's a big subject, and I think it's going to be one that hopefully will bring a lot of interest from you this week. I think that when I thought about this particular theme, it was because there's a lot of movement among Jesus scholars regarding Christ, what he did see and did not see, or did envision or did not envision within his lifetime. A lot of the Jesus scholars today are showing that Jesus did not foresee anything beyond his generation as far as the fulfillment of all the things that he was talking about. And then when we look out upon the world of scholarship, what we saw was a lot of movement within the Pauline field of studies. A lot of people studying Paul and talking about the new Paul versus the old Paul and all of those things. And some of them are starting to bring up some very good points that are worth our consideration. But it was somewhat frustrating that the Jesus scholars and the Pauline scholars never quite got together. They don't get together and sit down and talk about these things. And so I thought, well, we'll have a conference on Jesus and Paul. And then I thought about these scholars who just do nothing but study Jesus, and I thought about these scholars who do nothing but study Paul, and I thought about the scholars who make their whole career out of studying a three-verse passage out of Scripture, and what all of them would think if they heard we were having a conference on both Jesus and Paul. They would think we were absolutely crazy. But we don't use that word around here this week, do we? This is the only week of your life out of the year, well, you're not a heretic. You're right here among fellow believers, and we're all normal this week, okay? Regardless of what the scholars would say. Well, anyway, there's a lot of information. I want to start out with what I would call the two pillars of covenant eschatology. We like to talk in terms of covenant eschatology because we serve a covenant God who's given us a covenant book about a covenant people. Eschatology is simply about the doctrine of last things. So within covenant eschatology, we have these two pillars, one by Jesus and one by Paul. Jesus says in John 4:22 that salvation is of the Jews. And then Paul says in Romans 15:27 that the Gentiles are made partakers of Israel's spiritual things. Here is the key point. Both Israel and the Gentiles had to become partakers of Israel's spiritual things. If we don't see that point, then the two pillars are basically rendered useless. Well, we might ask the question, why was it that the Jews missed the kingdom? How many have had that question asked to you when you share your view of this? Why did they miss it? Okay, that response was totally unacceptable. I'm going to try this one more time. Let's start with this question. And I want you to acknowledge the answer by raising your hands, and I'll know you're with me, and it's not your dinner talking. How many are here this evening? Okay, we can proceed. Jesus wrestled with the Jews continuously over the issue of the coming kingdom and the nature of its coming. In other words, its manner. And the Jews missed the coming of this kingdom because they missed the manner of its coming. And Jesus said in Luke 17 that the kingdom would come without observation. And then he ties it in with the destruction of Jerusalem in Luke 21:31. And he says it will happen in this generation. That kingdom will come without observation, but it will come in this generation. Paul, as we shall see, spent a great deal of time trying to keep the Gentile mission field to which he was assigned, from coming into Israel's fleshly things and getting them into Israel's spiritual things. And we're going to find that this is an interpretive key that we could point to see where a lot of Pauline scholars miss the understanding of Paul. We'll look at that as it unfolds. So it's entirely possible that some of this has been missed because the Jews were expecting the kingdom to come in a much different manner, and the Gentiles quickly fell prey to the more Hellenistic aspects of the kingdom teaching as represented immediately following the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. Now, in this regard, there are a few things that we want to keep in mind about this event. First of all, pretty much the going thing of the day in AD 70 and after was either death or dispersion. If you were alive, then you were probably dispersed. That's basically the way it worked. There wasn't a lot of people hanging around to put the pieces of this back together. Secondly, by this event, all of the apostles except John had already been martyred. Now, here's something that I find fascinating about this. I'm going to talk to you a little more as the week progresses about a book that was just published called The End Times Controversy by Tim LaHaye and Thomas Ice. And we at Presence Ministries are responding in book form with a book entitled Battle for the Future. And we're going to battle for the future over the question, is the future constructive or is it catastrophic? But one of the points of that book against the fulfilled view is that Jesus said to his disciples, some of you standing here will not taste death till you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Well, if you look up the Greek word for some, it's the Greek word tibes. And guess what that word means? Somebody. Someone. Imagine Jesus in the audience of his disciples saying, somebody here will not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And then we jump to the end of John and we see the story of Peter asking Jesus about John, how will he die? And Jesus says, if I will that he remain until I come, what is that to you? You go and serve me. And so the rumor goes out that John would not die. But Jesus said, I didn't say John wouldn't die. I said, if I will that he remain until I come. Matthew 16:28, he said, somebody in this audience will not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. How many of Jesus' disciples made it to the foot of the cross in his crucifixion? Is it any coincidence that that is the somebody in his audience who lived to see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom and was the only one not martyred? Not only that, it's not until the 4th century that we have the canon of scriptures we possess it today. Look, they didn't have the destruction of Jerusalem and everybody went running out of the city and said, be sure to bring my New Testament with me. They didn't have this. How many are in a church that's messed up? Raise your hands. If your church is messed up, just raise your hand. Okay. Now look at Baytown. We got the Baytown group. They all agree on eschatology, but man, I've been there. That church is messed up. Okay. Look, having the Bible in your hand doesn't mean you're not going to have a bunch of messed up theology. These guys didn't even have a Bible in their hand. People say, well, how could they miss it? Why wouldn't somebody write about it? Who? Well, they might go on from there and say, well, the church officially. Look, by the time we get this canon of scripture in hand, it's in the 4th century and we've already got a state-run church. So what do people do today for verification of the inspired word? They go to the uninspired church fathers to get that verification. Who are you going to go to for that? Should we turn our attention to Tertullian and his arguing in defense of the primacy of the bishop? Should we turn to Irenaeus, the disciple of Polycarp, who was supposedly a disciple of John, and by the way, taught that Jesus lived to be 50 years old? Should we take his word for it? Tertullian, Irenaeus, Ignatius, Clement? They all disagree on a plethora of matters, and none of them address the subject of eschatology to any degree whatsoever. So this leads to a significant question. If we desire to understand how it is that salvation is of the Jews and that the Gentiles are to come into Israel's spiritual things, where in the world are we going to find this information? Well, here's a great idea. Let's go to the biblical text. But even this raises another important question. Can we really, 2,000 years later, be mining new truths from these ancient writings? Really? I mean, can we really get new truths 2,000 years later? Listen to how Millard Erickson responds to the idea of if it's new, it can't be true. This is very instructive for our study at hand. He says, and I quote, first, many doctrines were not articulated by the church for centuries. In the case of the person and work of Christ, the Trinity and other doctrines, beliefs were held implicitly and became explicit only when a deviant form of teaching arose or when a controversy broke out in the church. Eschatology, in particular, has not been elaborated in detail until rather recently. Further, other methods of Bible study and interpretation are also of relatively recent origin. Third, if we are making any progress in the study of the Bible, We must expect some things to be uncovered that were not previously known. To deny this undercuts all possibility of real progress in biblical and theological understanding, end quote. So in the end, it's to our primary source of information that we must turn for answers as to what occurred in that first century generation. Now, once we discover when it happened, we can debate about the how of its happening forever. You got that? Once we discover when it happened, we can debate about how it happened and talk about that forever. And I have no doubt we'll do just that. Well, it's my opinion, based on a broad read of historical millennialism, that the single biggest reason for scholars finding disharmony between Jesus and Paul is found in the fact that they divide the eschaton. When Jesus says this age, they see him as speaking before the cross and therefore of the old covenant age. And when he says the age to come, he must be speaking about after the cross. Then when they see Paul speaking about this age after the cross, they assume that he's speaking about the new covenant age. And therefore, when he speaks of the age to come, he must be talking about what we would call heaven or the next dimension. But it's one indivisible eschaton for both Jesus and Paul. When Jesus says this age, it's old covenant. The age to come, it's new covenant. When Paul says this age, it's old covenant. When he says age to come, it is new covenant. This makes best sense of the post-cross transition, where we have the old covenant going out and we have the new covenant coming in. And as you can see by the chart I drew, I had way too much coffee to drink that day. Jesus says, now when these things begin to take place, stand up, raise up your heads, because your redemption is drawing near, Luke 21:28. And then verse 31, he says that the kingdom is near. He ties it to the destruction of Jerusalem. Paul says, you know what time it is, how it is now the moment for you to wake from sleep, for salvation is nearer than when we first believed. The night is far gone. Is the Christian age the night? Did Jesus die to establish the night? Could it be that Paul and Jesus really are on the same page, talking about the same event? Well, what's often missed is the fact that both Jesus and Paul tie redemption and salvation to the AD 70 coming, or parousia, or covenantal presence of Jesus Christ. Well, let me give you a good example of how skewed our thinking can be in the 21st century. The illustration I want to use is the illustration of how we view the gospel and prophecy. We see them as two subjects today. How many of you have gone to study with someone and they say, look, prophecy's confusing. I don't want to talk about prophecy. You know, what's really important is the gospel of Jesus Christ. As if they're two separate things. Take them through this exercise. If you really love the gospel, then you know you would have loved it on the day of Pentecost, right? Let's go back to the first century, and we're all Jewish converts. We've just seen the miraculous outpouring of the Spirit. We've heard the preaching of Peter. We are Jews, but we've accepted this Messiah. It's undeniable evidence, and we follow it. Now, we go out of this meeting very excited, and we want to convert our friends and our family. And so we go and we begin to preach the gospel, you know, that your friend says is the most important thing. What do our Jewish friends and family say in the first century, the day after Pentecost, when we go preach the gospel that our friends say they love so much? Are you crazy? Jesus. We've got Moses. We have 1,500 years of law history written by the finger of God. We have a priesthood. We have genealogical records. We've never missed a feast day, even when it fell on a Wednesday night. We have the priesthood, the sacrificial system, and the temple. And you're telling me that my God, who we've served for 1,500 years and lives in that temple, is no longer in that temple? What is the greatest obstacle standing between our Jewish friend or relative in the first century and them accepting Christ? What is the single biggest symbol standing in the way? The temple. And how many times must they have heard, if God is no longer living in that temple, wouldn't he just take it away? Probably a lot. Jesus said, and this good news of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. Matthew 24:14. Paul said, you have heard of this hope before the word of the truth, the gospel that has come to you, just as it is bearing fruit in all the world, by the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, have been made a minister. Jesus gave the Great Commission, and Paul said it was fulfilled. And we can argue about if that went to China or not all day long. This is what we know. Jesus said, go do it. Paul said, we've done it. What is the question? Why did they have to take that gospel to the whole world? You know, even the Assyrians on the boat with Jonah as he's running away knew of the Hebrew God. They cast lots. They find out whose fault it is. They say, who are you? Where are you from? Where are you from? What have you done? What are you up to? He says, I'm a Hebrew and I serve the God of the Hebrews. And the passage says, the men became exceedingly afraid. Why? Because the whole world knew of the Hebrew God. And you better believe they knew where he lived too. And before that Hebrew God would take away that temple that represented his presence, he wanted the world to know that he would no longer live and dwell in a box. And we've gathered together as citizens of that kingdom to proclaim to the world that we will no longer live in a box made by man with hands either. Right? That is good news. So regarding the gospel of the kingdom, both Jesus and Paul saw the necessity of taking this news to the whole world. Jesus said, for the Son of Man is going to come in the glory of with his angels and the glory of his Father, and then he will repay everyone according to what he has done. Truly I tell you, there are some standing here, or someone standing here, who will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Paul said, for we declare to you by the word of the Lord that we who are alive and who are left until the coming of the Lord will by no means precede those who have died. If this isn't evidence that both Jesus and Paul believed that the Lord would return in that generation and that some in their audiences would be alive to see it, then where in the world are we going to find that evidence? You will not find greater testimony that Jesus and Paul are on the same page of the hymnal than that. So here's our major premise. Both Jesus and Paul spoke of the exact same eschaton. The term this age for both of them meant the present Jewish age that was in the process of fading away. And the term age to come for both of them spoke of the complete establishment of the new covenant age or world. Well, that's just a brief summary or overview of Jesus and Paul together. Now let's break them down individually. Regarding current trends in Pauline studies, did you know that according to the latest scholarship, there's a new Paul? How many of you knew that? There's a new Paul. Yeah, he's still bald. He's not a very good speaker and all those things. But they're looking at the old Paul in a new way. Some very interesting things that they're saying. Well, this might leave us asking the question then, what was the old Paul and how is the new Paul different? I'm very glad that you asked that. I'll be citing much of this information from the work of an author named John G. Geiger, entitled Reinventing Paul. Geiger's one of the foremost Pauline scholars today, so I thought it'd be good to follow his line of reasoning. You can't take them all, not in one night anyway. For years it's been said that Paul was the second founder of Christianity, Jesus being the first founder. Now many have seen the old Paul as having left Judaism. Follow this thinking. If you've drifted away, come back. Many have seen the old Paul as having left Judaism, being converted to Christianity, and renouncing his faith of old and taking in hand his newfound faith. Much of this reasoning comes from the antithetical statements made by Paul regarding Israel and her law and her status before God. Let's look at a set of anti-Israel sayings by Paul. Galatians 3:10, for all who rely on works of the law are under a curse. Now it is evident that no man is justified before God by the law. For neither circumcision counts for anything, nor uncircumcision, but a new creation. For no human being will be justified in his sight by works of the law, since through the law comes knowledge of sin. Israel, who pursued righteousness, which is based on the law, did not succeed in fulfilling that law. As regards the gospel, they are enemies of God for your sake. But their minds were hardened. For to this day, when they read the old covenant, that same veil remains unlifted, because only through Christ is it taken away. Yes, to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their mind. But when a man turns to the Lord, the veil is removed. So when you look at this group of passages and others like them, for some, it seems very convincing. Paul must have experienced a conversion to a new religion and began immediately denouncing his old religion. Well, then you have the pro-Israel set of sayings by Paul. What is the advantage of the Jew? Or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. Do we overthrow the law through faith? By no means. On the contrary, we uphold the law. What shall we say? That the law is sin? By no means. Thus, the law is holy, and the commandment is holy and just and good. To the Israelites belong the sonship, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the temple, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and of their race, according to the flesh, is the Christ. Has God rejected his people? By no means. All Israel will be saved. Is the law then against the promises of God? Certainly not. So in sum, the problem is obvious, we are told. The study of Paul leads to contradiction and confusion. So what are we to do? First, regarding the old school. It's at this point, and this is a shamefully short overview I'm giving, that Geiger compels us to understand the cornerstone of the old Paul school of thinking. The old school reasons Paul was a Jew, yes, but he experienced a great conversion. With reference to the new school, in the mind of Geiger, if we can dismiss the claim that Paul's turning was a conversion, it will help us to sort out the new Paul. For this, he turns to Christer Stendahl, a theologian who was quite revolutionary for his time. Writing in his 1976 work, Paul Among Jews and Gentiles, Stendahl surmises that a closer reading of the accounts both in Acts and those by Paul himself reveals a greater continuity between Paul before and after his Damascus Road experience. For Stendahl, quote, "Here is not that change of religion that we commonly associate with the word conversion. Serving the one and the same God, Paul receives a new and special calling in God's service. God's Messiah asked him, as a Jew, to bring God's message to the Gentiles. The emphasis in the accounts is always on this assignment, not on a conversion." So the bottom line for both Stendahl and Geiger is that Paul was called rather than converted. Now, here's what's at stake. If we disagree with this and say that Paul was converted, this leaves open, and perhaps even presupposes, that Jesus did in fact begin a new religion, one to which Paul was converted, thus severing his ties with the past. However, this doesn't do justice to the fact that Jesus said salvation was of the Jews, John 4:22, and that Paul strenuously defends Israel to the Gentiles when he tells them in Romans 11 that they, the Gentiles, are wild olive branches that have been grafted into Israel's olive tree. Paul's point is seminal. If God rejects Israel, the results for the Gentiles are disastrous. By implication, then, we see in the ministry of Paul a defense of Israel, even in her hardened state. I'm sure we'll talk a lot more about that this week. On the other hand, if we agree that Paul was called rather than converted, then we must admit that the break between the Old and New Covenants was not and is not as clean as perhaps many of us were taught to believe. So what is the solution for Geiger? We must see that the pro-Israel teachings are because Paul is a Jew called to take a good news kingdom message to the Gentiles, but when dealing with the law issues to the Gentiles, Paul introduces his anti-Israel teachings because, quote, his arguments concern the law in relation to his Gentile converts and have nothing to do with Judaism. Furthermore, Geiger states, yes, the law had been a curse and had resulted in enslavement. Yes, the law and circumcision has been transcended now by Christ, but all of this applies to the Gentiles, not to Israel. That is where we feel that Geiger and the new Paul advocates are missing it as much as the old Paul advocates. Remember that we said the Gentiles were to come into Israel's spiritual things? This is the basis for Paul speaking in ways that some perceive as negative regarding the practices of the law. His point is that the law leads to Christ, but that in and of itself, the law is the way neither for Gentiles nor for Jews. The time had come for both to transcend into the spiritual realities of Israel's covenant promises and go past Christ and go with Christ into the full presence of God. Now let me say that again, because a lot of people today in Christianity have stopped short of God in Christ, just as the Jews stopped short of God in the law. Both Jew and Gentile, to come into Israel's spiritual things, had to go with Christ and past Christ into the Father's house. Does that make sense? You have questions? Get your French vanilla cappuccino and meet me at 2 this morning. We'll talk about this. Let me give a summary of this. As stated by Paul in 2 Corinthians 3:7, the old Mosaic system was, though glorious, nonetheless a system of death. It was to lead to that which was the more glorious, as found in Christ. In this light, the teachings of Paul were to both Jew and Gentile. To say, as do the old advocates, that Paul turned against the law is to misread and to misunderstand Paul. He knew that the law was holy and good, but he also knew that no man could keep it. Thus, what was good proved to bring separation from God. However, to say, as do the new Paul advocates, that Paul's perceived negative comments about the law were only for the Gentiles and had nothing to do with Israel is to overstate the case. It's to miss the balance of a transition that is taking place that both Jesus and Paul agreed on. Well, as the week progresses, Doug and Max in the morning session are going to answer all of these questions perfectly and completely and fully. Right? No, right, Dad. He pointed at that. That's not a bad idea. Let me summarize the ministries of Jesus and Paul as I see them in the following chart, and then we'll turn our attention to Jesus. You have the allegory of Paul in Galatians 4. You have two women who represent two worlds. They represent two covenant worlds. There's an old and there's a new. Hagar is in slavery. Sarai is free. Hagar gives birth to Ishmael. He is in bondage. Sarai gives birth to Isaac, and he is the free man. So there are two covenants, two sons, two women, two mountains, and two cities, and they also are summarized by the terms flesh and spirit. And from this perspective, Jesus says in John 6 that the flesh profits nothing, but the spirit is life. With that in mind, let's turn from Paul to the ministry of Jesus. As we leaned on Geiger for our understanding of Pauline studies, we're going to be taking a lot of this information from the scholar N.T. Wright, a classic theologian on Jesus studies. The first question is, why did God choose the first century into which to interject himself? Why then? Why at that time? Did it matter? When we look at history, what do we see? Well, to answer this, we have to begin by asking, who was Jesus? Not who has he become, because that's our very skewed ideas today that we're dealing with. But who is Jesus? Jesus scholar Dr. Scott McKnight, who spoke with us last year at the conference, reminds us that we cannot understand Jesus until we have put this human figure into his Jewish context. Now, it's going to be helpful to start to acknowledge that over centuries, the church has viewed Jesus in many different ways. There has been no one view of Jesus. When people talk to us today about our view of Jesus as if we're out of line, there is no one line. There's a lot of lines, and none of them are very deep. We understand that? So with great confidence, that alone is a good argument for why we need to dig deeper. In some instances, dramatic shifts in the way that Jesus has been perceived have come about through historical development and enlightenment. For example, for centuries, Jesus was held aside from history and simply accepted as a person above or separate from history. For much of this time, not much probing was done regarding the historical person and ministry of Christ. Many were content to view Jesus as an icon, while others were insistent that he was either a failed revolutionary, political revolutionary, such as Reimerus, or a failed apocalyptic prophet, such as Schweitzer. Still others, according to N.T. Wright, to a large extent the Reformers, quote, focused not on the Jesus of history for his own sake, but on the results and the benefits of his work, end quote. That is the product of the Reformation against which you and I struggle today. People began to see Jesus for the results of seeing Jesus and for the benefits that Jesus brought. And they say, I don't want to study prophecy. I don't want to study that book of the Bible. I don't want to go through this discipline. Just tell me what I get from believing in Jesus. Well, what you get is a figment of your imagination about who you think Jesus is. Because if you want to know the historical Jesus, you have to begin where he began on the road to Emmaus, with Moses and the prophets and all who came before. That is where you find the story of Jesus and therefore the gospel, which is nothing less than the good news. Well, it's the responsibility of each successive generation to take up the task of understanding and interpreting Christ for themselves. Now, more than ever, says Wright, 20th century scholarship has at least one great advantage over its predecessors. Since Weitz and Schweitzer at the turn of the century, it has been realized that Jesus must be understood in his Jewish historical context. This is where the Jesus scholars, and particularly the Third Quest for the Historical Jesus movement, is doing us great favors today. They are uncovering this historical Jesus, and for the first time, the church is being challenged to get away from the icon of Christ and grasp who Jesus really is. This is causing people to relook at Paul and try to understand who he is. And one of these days, somebody's going to get the bright idea that Jesus and Paul were inspired by the same source. And when that happens, once again, the world will have discovered fire. Well, regardless of how one sees the plan of God, Paul makes clear that its origin was in the mind of God before time began, Titus 1:2, in hope the God who cannot lie promised us eternal life before time began. I'm not done yet. Okay. During the history of the people of Israel, covenant blessings and covenant curses abound. They go through periods of time where they're out of God's favor and they're exiled. One of the greatest of these happened in 586 BC at the hands of the Babylonians. During this time, they went into exile. After a while, they came out of exile. And then, though they were out of exile, they came to understand and see themselves as a people still in exile in many ways. In other words, they were restored to the land, but they knew in their identity they were still somehow, some way, to some extent, exiled from God. That's a very key element in understanding the setting into which Jesus comes. Well, this is what leads to attention. A situation described as one of tension and tragedy, mounting tension between the faith they professed, but the facts they perceived. They professed this faith in God, but they perceived that they were alienated from him. Well, added to the thoughts about when this deliverance would take place were questions regarding the how of its occurrence, and exactly if God was going to step into history and deliver them, would they have to play a role in it? Fresh in the minds of the Jews in the day of Jesus was the Maccabean revolt. We all know of that, or most of us know about that. That's where Antiochus Epiphanes went into the city, decided to have Jerusalem as a buffer state between himself and Rome. He set up an altar on the Jewish burnt offering altar, sacrificed a pig, wanted to worship Zeus, caused a little problem with the Jews, tremendously underestimated them. 3 years to the day, they took the temple back over on December 25th, and then they set up this Feast of Lights, or this great celebration that we might call today Hanukkah. Well, the Jews had this in mind, and they thought, well, maybe if we will act as did the Maccabees years earlier, and we will rise up in revolt against our Roman persecutors, that God will act on our behalf again in our day. Jesus steps into this very loaded situation with all of these zealotry movements thinking about how is it that we will in fact act so that it will initiate God coming in on our behalf. Does that sound like any groups today? Yeah, I bet Dr. Sizer will bring us a lesson or two about groups thinking along those lines. Well, even though it had been years since the Maccabean period happened, there were certain questions that were on the Jews' minds. Wright shapes these out very well. He says, first of all, they asked the question, who are we? The answer is, we are Israel, the chosen people of the Creator God. Where are we? The answer is, we're in the Holy Land, focused on the temple, but paradoxically, we're still in exile. The third question is, what is wrong? The answer is we have the wrong rulers. Pagans on the one hand, compromised Jews on the other, or halfway in between we have Herod and his family. We're not happy with that either. We're involved in a less than ideal situation. Well, what is the solution? Answer, our God must act to give us the true sort of kingship that we desire. Well, what must be seen is that God was in fact going to provide a king, but it was going to be in a very different manner than they themselves had hoped. It's within this context that Jesus enters and begins a ministry directly challenging the symbols of his time, particularly ones such as the temple, the Sabbath, and the nation, and the land. Symbolically, Jesus saw himself as the fulfillment of all of these things. Instead of the temple being the house of God, who became the house? We were all into the body of Christ in that first century generation. That was the temple of God. Well, Wright claims that his deepest belief regarding the temple was eschatological. The time for God to act had come, and the way he would act was at the hands of the Romans. Well, we say all of this to say that the period of Second Temple Judaism was comprised of a people who held revolt fresh in their minds, the uprising of the Maccabees, coupled with an anticipation of God soon acting on their behalf to deliver them from exile, poverty, and oppression at the hands of a pagan nation. It was a time of holy desperation and holy anticipation. Even so, there was a multiplicity of views for what constituted the true community of God and even the role one might play in triggering his intervention on behalf of the community of faith. It's into this climate Jesus speaks and says, "The kingdom's coming is at hand." There couldn't have been a time in history where the ideas of the people were any more piqued for the intervention of God than the ministry into which Jesus enters. That was the climax of history. So more than ever, the true setting of Jesus in the Jewish nation in that first century in which he ministered is critical for unveiling much of the mystery of how prophecy was or was not fulfilled. Well, Jesus must have taught his disciples well because they too, in concert with Paul, wrote of this climax of history. In the book of Acts, Peter quoted the prophecy of Joel, affirming that they had at long last entered the last days. He spoke of his day in terms of a judgment that was coming upon the household of God, saying that all things, the end of all things, were near. He professed that his day was the time spoken of by all the prophets, as many as had spoken from Samuel and those after him. So near was the action of God on behalf of his people that John affirmed it was the last hour. Paul said to his generation, they were the ones upon whom the ends of the ages had come. And he taught no other things than what Moses and the prophets said would take place. The writer of the book of Hebrews, in language too clear to overlook, said that in a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. Well, the words of Jesus left a profound imprint upon his disciples, because he proclaimed, these are the days of vengeance in which all things written shall be fulfilled. Who was Paul? Paul was a Jew. He loved the law and he loved the God of the law, but he understood the spiritual realities of the law. Who was Jesus? Jesus was the Son of God. He loved the law, he loved the God of the law. Will we ever begin to see that their ministries were identical in so many ways? Well, a lot of people want to say Jesus didn't go to the other people. He just came to the Jewish people. Well, if salvation was of the Jews, wouldn't that make most sense? And wouldn't it also make most sense that God would reach into the Jewish people and bring out a Hebrew of Hebrews to lead the rest of them out? It seems that he would. So in conclusion, if we're to understand Jesus and Paul, we have to understand that the gospel was rooted in the promises made to Israel, that neither Jesus nor Paul breaks off from Israel. Rather, they consistently agree and affirm that the new creation springs forth from Israel. Well, we come back to our original question. Is it really possible to find new things in this ancient text today? In answering this, we again turn to the words of Erickson as we draw this presentation to a close. He says, James Orr, lecturing at the end of the 19th century, observed that various areas of Christian doctrine had received special attention and development at different periods in the history of the church. Thus, in the second century, the church dealt especially with apologetics and the fundamental ideas of Christianity. In the third and fourth centuries, they dealt with the doctrine of God. In the early fifth century, they dealt with man and sin. In the fifth to seventh centuries, they dealt with the person of Christ. In the 11th to 16th centuries, they dealt with the atonement, and in the latter part of the 16th century, they dealt with the application of redemption, justification, etc. It was as crises arose in these areas and at these particular periods that the positions were more precisely articulated or suggested that the peculiar interest of the modern age is eschatology, the one remaining undeveloped topic of theology in the church. Well, that, ladies and gentlemen, is why we have gathered this week. Now is the day for the people of God to work out the eschatological challenges of Scripture. And I'm thrilled that you've come to do it. And I know we'll all play an equal part in it. So thank you for being here. Thank you.